They're going out. If you'll find Genesis 36, as we get back to Genesis today. Genesis 36. You probably, like me, have at some time walked through a cemetery reading the gravestones, and maybe you came across a particular inscription on one that just made you stop and just ponder what that person's life had been like because of what was written on that particular gravestone. It's not a bad idea to visit cemeteries from time because they can make you stop and think that unless the Lord returns, that someday I'm going to be in a graveyard. There's going to be a gravestone over my grave. There's going to be the years of my birth and death, and maybe some little inscription on the gravestone as well. And so as you walk through cemeteries and think about things like that, it can provoke some questions in us, such as, how do I want to be remembered? I don't want the people that really knew me to remember me. What do I want to accomplish in this brief little dash between when I was born and when I die? And then most importantly, am I living for the things that really do count in life and eternity? As we come to Genesis 36 today, I've got some news for you. We come across another chapter in Genesis that's full of genealogies. I've done my share of genealogy preaching in this book of Genesis. But this time it's listing for us the descendants of Esau. And while I don't anticipate it becoming one of your favorite chapters in the Bible, I would suggest to you that it can be a little like walking through a cemetery because it can make us stop and think about life and what so many people call success in life. If you think about it, or maybe you don't know about it yet, but Esau, from a worldly standpoint, was a very successful man. He was the founder of a dynasty of a powerful nation. He was the father of rulers and kings. He had financial prosperity. He had beautiful women for wives. He was a famous man in his time. But Esau lived for the world and not for the Lord. And so he failed miserably where it mattered the most, in his relationship with God. And as Hebrews in the New Testament tells us, it calls him an immoral and godless man. And so Esau was a successful man who most likely is in hell today. A successful, very successful man. And yet is in eternal torment today. So before we get into this chapter, let me just kind of give you some suggestions of maybe why God even included this chapter. I mean, this isn't even a chapter listing, you know, the promised descendants. This is Esau. So why even bother to give us all this information? And I'm not going to awe you with all my pronunciation of these great names here, so we'll just have to skip over that. But here's some reasons maybe why God chose to put this chapter in the Bible. Number one, to record the fulfillment of God's promises to Esau. If you remember, even though Esau had forfeited his birthright and his blessing, God still promised to bless this man and to make a great nation out of him. And so God is a faithful God to keep his promises even to someone like an Esau. And we see that, the fulfillment of his promises here to this man. So it's a proof that God was honoring his promises even to godless Esau. Another reason was to protect the descendants of Esau. And what I mean by that is this. If you remember, who were the very first readers of the book of Genesis? It was the children of Israel in the wilderness as they prepared to go into the promised land. Moses was the one who was putting all this together in a written form for the people. And so they were the first ones to read this section. And you remember, as they made their way out of Egypt, they had to eventually get to the place where they were going to cross over the Jordan River, go into the promised land to, under God's orders, destroy the wicked, evil Canaanites. Well, the shortest way to get there, not the shortest way, because they messed that up, didn't they? But the second shortest way after they got out in the wilderness was to go through a nation called Edom, who were the descendants of Esau. Edom was, if you can picture the Dead Sea, it was south, southeast of the Dead Sea. And so the quickest way was to go up through Edom. And so they requested permission from the king of Edom to go through the land. Moses even said, we'll pay for any water, any food we take. We'll pay you for it. And Edom said, no way. You're not going to come through our country. And so they had to do a detour, go a much longer way to get to the land of Canaan. And so perhaps after Israel crossed over Jordan, conquered Jordan, maybe someone would have piped up and said, you know, those Edomites, they were a real pain. We had to go back there and show them a lesson themselves for what they caused us. And yet God had spoken to Moses and the leaders and said, you do not provoke Edom. I am not going to give you any of their land. God even referred to them. One of the reasons you don't do this is because they are your brothers through Esau. And so God had made a promise concerning the people of Edom. And so we see who these people are now. Israel, as they were reading this, would have known who the people were. But a third reason, and this is important, it was to make Israel, as well as us, consider the outcome, the result of Esau's profane life, especially when it's contrasted with Jacob's. Because there's a contrast here between chapter 36, which outlines the wealth, the success, the power of Esau and his descendants. And then, flip over to chapter 37, verse 1, and it says this. Now Jacob, here's the contrast. Now Jacob lived in a land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. So here's Esau, while he's out conquering lands, making a name for himself, making a nation, producing kings and chieftains from his descendants. Here's Jacob over here, living in a land that's not even his own. It's just the place where his fathers had lived for a number of years. And so if you look at that, you say, wow, what success, earthly success Esau was. Look at the power. Look at the descendants. Look at the land. Look at the dynasty he left. But here's Jacob. He's got nothing. He doesn't even own the land he's living on. And yet, Jacob was the one who was the real success in God's eyes, not Esau. So those are maybe some reasons God gives us long list of names for us in chapter 36. But here's the thesis we want to work with today. If we succeed by worldly standards but fail with God, we fail with what really matters, don't we? If we succeed in this world, have all the fame, power, all the stuff like Esau had, and yet fail with God, okay, you may have a few years of acclaim and so forth, but you fail at what really matters and what will matter for eternity. And so I want to just lift out of this chapter four areas where Esau and his descendants succeeded in this world but failed miserably in what really matters, which was their relationship with God. So here's the first area. A beautiful family by the world's standards does not equal a family that is blessed by God. You can have a beautiful family by the world standards, many in our culture do, but that doesn't mean you are blessed by God. Think about it. Esau, he began his family outside of God's blessing by marrying Canaanite wives. Look at verse 2, back to chapter 36, verse 2. It tells us Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. Now, if you remember, Abraham had gone to great lengths to make sure his son did not marry a Canaanite woman. And then Jacob also did not marry Canaanite women. But it's almost like Esau just kind of shrugged that off, shrugged off the warning of his godly grandfather, and he married, as we read about in chapter 26, Canaanite wife that brought great grief, it said, to his parents. And then later on, still lacking any kind of care or discernment, we read he also married a wife from the tribe of Ishmael, from the descendants of Ishmael. And so he had multiple wives, three at least, and they all were from the immoral, godless line of Ishmael or the Canaanites. Now listen, especially those of you who aren't married yet. A person's choice in marriage reveals, showcases something of their values in life. And it becomes, the person you choose to marry becomes a major force in your life. And so to those of you who aren't married, please, please, please be careful who you choose. Choose your spouse wisely, because he or she will bring great joy or great heartache to your life. And please don't be sucked in and deceived by the aura of being in love. Because it doesn't have to be, but can be. That feeling of being in love can quickly disappear when the realities of married life set in. You see it happen all the time. So choose and go forward in biblical wisdom, not just based on the feeling of I'm in love. But as you read these opening verses, something else we note about Esau here, about his family, is that Esau's wives, in contrast to Rebekah and Sarah and Rachel, gave him children. There's not any hint that there was barrenness with Esau's wives. We read here, you read down through verses 4 through 6 and so forth, there were at least 5 sons, daughters that were born. No mention of years of barrenness here. Where the people in the line of God's promise, Sarah was barren for a while, Rebekah was barren for a while, Rachel was barren for a while, Esau didn't have any problem. Wives are spitting out kids. Then also we see here, and we're going to do a little word study here, Esau's wives were no doubt beautiful women. And we picked that up because of their names. Now remember, names just weren't given because, hey, I like that name, I read that one in a book. They were given because of characteristics about a person. So look at verse 2. The first wife, Ada, it means ornament or adorned one. The second wife, Oholibama, verse 2. Now don't go off on this yet. It means tent height. That doesn't sound too great, but what it's really speaking of is someone who's tall and stately. Tall and stately. Then there's the third wife mentioned in verse 3, Basma, which means the perfumed one or fragrance. And so we have the ornament, the adorned one. We have the one tall and stately. We have the perfumed one or fragrance. So notice each of the names focuses on some outward aspect of beauty or even sensuality. So Esau apparently was a lover of fine, attractive women. That's who he wanted for wives. We see the same thing in our culture. So often the rich and famous, they want, you know, the athletes, they want to have their showcase wives, or I guess wives want to have showcase husbands. I don't know if it works that way or not. But we see the same thing happening in our culture. Next, as you just kind of glance down through the chapter, as the descendants have started to be named, you'll notice several times throughout the chapter, it's talked about that these sons, these grandsons, these great-grandsons were either kings or chieftains, rulers, chiefs. And so Esau produced a slew of kings and rulers and chiefs. So you put it all together, and Esau had a very attractive family by world standards, outwardly speaking. His wives were beautiful who bore him children. His children and his grandchildren were born leaders. They were talented. They were strong. Esau, if you remember, was a skilled outdoorsman. He was a man who got caught up with the enjoyment of the good life. But there was one big problem. And that was God was not part of this family. There's no hint of that. So Esau, the grandson of godly Abraham, the favorite son of his father Isaac, was a thoroughly secular man, godless man, who lived for the pleasure of the here and now. So here we have a successful man by worldly standards. Sons, grandsons are successful by worldly standards, but they all failed at what matters most because they left God out of their lives. And therefore, they missed God's blessing on their family, on their descendants. And so for us today who are parents, grandparents, the most important thing we can impart to our children is not how to be a worldly success. And sometimes it's easy to just get caught up in that. You know, the kid's starting position on a sports team or they are winning these contests, these championships, or they're excellent in school, and they score well on the SAT or whatever other test they take, and they get college scholarships, they get the well-paying jobs. But that's not bad in and of itself. But if they fail with God, all that stuff doesn't matter. And so we need to make sure that they know what it means to succeed with the Lord, not just by worldly standards. Esau's life is a contrast that helps us see that. So a beautiful family by world standards does not equal a family blessed by God. A second thing we see here is that material prosperity does not equal spiritual prosperity. I want us to look at verses 6, 7, and 8. Moses is writing about Esau relocating. And so it begins in verse 6. Then Esau took his wives and his sons and his daughters and all his household and his livestock and all his cattle and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan and went to another land away from his brother Jacob. For their property had become too great for them to live together. And the land where they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock. So Esau lived in the hill country of Seir. Esau is Edom. Sounds a little bit like the account of Abraham and Lot, does it not? But Esau had begun to settle probably around, among his wife's relatives. And at some point, he made the move permanent. Maybe in this, he probably initially made the move even before Jacob came back from his time with Laban. But maybe he made the move permanent when he came to the full grasp and understanding that it was Jacob that was going to receive his father's inheritance as the one who has the birthright now. And so maybe at that point Esau decided to go off and make a name for himself. And so he goes and lives in the land of Seir and begins really become the primary person there. But what we note here is that Esau was a man who had greatly prospered, had great wealth. Again, success by worldly standards. But I think God could have very easily at this point spoken to Esau what he would speak thousands of years later to the church at Laodicea. Remember the words the church, he said, church at Laodicea, I'm wealthy, not as not as good, miserable, I could have said Esau. He is a Christian, have even a lower level middle compared to the world, we are so blessed here. And yet we talked in the February, we have been in being poor and in heaven. If, throughout history, there have been poor than me and a joy. So many Christians, so long, they find works hard for themselves, be deprived, you know, this can't have they work for their wrong that. Just the core. We in shall prepare to our die spirit of your spirit. Work just hard, hard, be blessed with prosperity, just spiritual property. A third thing, political power does not equal power with God. We see this again with Esau. He and his descendants had great political power. They're called, as I said throughout this chapter, so often referred to as chiefs or kings. Look at verse 31. It's very pointedly stated here in verse 31 that these men, these descendants of Esau, reigned as kings in Edom before any king reigned in Israel. So remember now, God had promised to Abraham, he repeated it to Jacob, that kings would come forth from their descendants. Kings would come forth. And yet what this verse 31 is saying to us is, here are Esau's sons and grandsons who walked away from God, and yet they had the distinction of being kings long before any of Jacob's descendants had become kings. Jacob's sons were a nation of slaves in Egypt when many of Esau's sons and grandsons were kings. It would have been very easy, maybe it did happen, I don't know, but it would have been very easy for some of Esau's descendants to look at Jacob's descendants and say, where's your God? I thought he promised kings in your line. We've got kings in our line. I don't see any in your line. Who's really doing well here? Who's really blessed here? But that's how often it seems, isn't it? That the world wins and God's people loses. We know God has promised that we're going to reign with Him, but right now in this world, so often Christians and churches are the ones really persecuted and mocked and laughed at by those in power and influence in our culture. And yet, We've got to remember that political or earthly power and power with God are two entirely different things, aren't they? I love this verse when you think about this concept of the way the church is mocked today. Some we do bring on ourselves. But the way the church is laughed at, I love this verse in Psalm chapter 2, verse 4. God declares, "He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord scoffs at them." The Lord's not threatened at all. The book of Daniel, it reminds us that it is the Lord who removes kings and establishes kings. So while it's fine for Christians, we need to be involved in politics and other places of power and influence, we need to keep things in the proper perspective, don't we? Where real power comes from. Because political power, any other kind of power, influence, is always subject to the Lord, who the Bible says is the ruler. God is the ruler over the realm of mankind, and He bestows it on whomever He wishes, whoever He desires. True power, though, is having power with God. Think about this. Let's go back in our study of Genesis for a minute. Just think about this. Who did God appear to and tell about His secret plans of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah? It was Abraham. Of Abraham, He said, you remember the well-known verse, "Shall I hide from," not some powerful person, not this, "shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do?" I mean, who doesn't want to be a confidant of Almighty God? And yet we have this verse in Psalm 25, 14 that says, "The secret of the Lord is for those who fear Him." I've given it to you some other translations up there as well. It reads in ESV, "the friendship of the Lord," or "the secret counsel of the Lord," or "the Lord confides in those who fear Him." That, brethren, is having real power. Having someone the Lord confides in. Who was it that displayed power with God when He prayed over King Abimelech and his household for his wife's wombs that God had closed to be open? It was Abraham. Prayed over King Abimelech's house. Who had the power there? Who was it that initiated a covenant with Isaac instead of the other way around? You would think Isaac would go initiate a covenant with a king to make sure he's safe. But who was it that initiated a covenant with Isaac because he saw Isaac was the one that God was with? God was blessed. That was another King Abimelech. And who is it we're going to see in however long it takes us to get there, toward the end of his life, who is it that blesses Pharaoh, king of the mighty Egyptians? Who was it? Just an old shepherd named Jacob. So in all of those examples, who are the ones who really had the power? Because they had power with and from the Lord. So a person can have great power, influence, position in this world, love to boast about it, and yet power with God is available to anyone, any Christ follower who really seeks to walk in trust and obedience to the Lord. Can you think of any verse that would emphasize that, that would say this kind of power is available to any true Christ follower who walks in trust and obedience? It's not just the pastor saying it to build y'all up. But in other words, a verse that says this is available for anyone, not just the high and mighty, not just the pastors, not just the elders. You know the verse that came to my mind? You know it. James 5:16. The effective, fervent prayer of not just a pastor, not just an elder, not just an important Christian person, but a righteous person does what? Accomplishes much. Avails much. And then he contrasts that with Elijah. Well, Elijah, we expect it. No, but Elijah was what? He was someone just like you and me. This kind of power with God that God uses for His glory is available to any righteous, God-fearing, God-following believer. All right, one last one. We'll be done. Temporal fame does not equal eternal recognition by God. I called your attention earlier to chapter 37, verse 1. that says, now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned in the land of Canaan. And so here again, while Esau was out conquering the land of Edom, founding a nation, fathering kings and rulers, making a great worldly success for him, Jacob's quietly living in the land where his fathers lived, in a land that he did not own. And so if you think about it, if you chart it, we will discover that Esau, in his day, really was more famous than Jacob was. Esau was the one who had the dynasty. In fact, when they get to the end of their lives, Jacob, at the end of his life, has about 70 or so descendants who are under the umbrella of Pharaoh and his protection. Esau has kings. Esau conquered Edom, established a dynasty there. Then in Moses' day, roughly 400 or so years after this, Israel was a fledgling nation that had just escaped enslavement by the Egyptians, owning no land of their own, wandering around in the wilderness. And yet here was Edom, already an established kingdom which had power, even power to refuse Israel access to their lands. So it seemed like the fame was with Esau. But the thing I want you to understand is this. God, not man, writes the final chapter. Do you realize that today, we don't know anything about the descendants of Esau. They've gone off into history. All their power, all their fame, all their influence. Basically, we hardly know anything more about Esau's descendants today than we knew when the Bible was written. And yet, the descendants of Jacob, Israel, they're in the news almost daily, aren't they? Israel is going forward. Israel is thriving. Israel, Glenn brought out, is going to be a centerpiece in God's future dealings on this planet. We don't even know anything about Esau's descendants. We can't even identify them. They're long forgotten. And yet there's a little bit play in history. The descendants of Esau in New Testament times were known as Idumeans. And some of their descendants, you know them, Herod the Great, his successor, Herod Antipas, during the time of Jesus. Herod the Great, he was the man who had all the baby boys slaughtered in Bethlehem. Herod Antipas was the man who had John the Baptist beheaded, who was the one who mocked Jesus before his crucifixion. Who was in power and fame then? It looked like Esau's descendants. Because here's Herod in his palace. Here's descendant of Jacob, Jesus, being crucified. And yet, the Herods, great powerful men, are in hell today. Jesus was raised from the dead and is coming back in all power and glory to rule forever and ever and ever. And so we see this principle even played out in the life of Jesus. So, what really matters is recognition by God, not by this world. And you know, we live in a culture that worships fame. I mean, if a person becomes a Christian, boy, we rush their life story into print. We put them on talk shows. We have people who, with all some of these reality shows, just striving for fame. We worship fame. So many people striving for that. But the recognition that we really will want and value is if we hear words from Jesus, well done. Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your Lord. That's going to be the recognition you really are going to want to hear. And no other worldly recognition will even come into a close second to that recognition, that eternal recognition, where we will be blessed throughout eternity. So, let's close with a question. What are you really living for? Not in terms of your words, if you would answer that question right now, but what are you really living for in terms of your actual priorities, in terms of your actual daily choices and actions and values? What would it reveal about what we are really living for? It's the most crucial question to ask ourselves, what we're really living for. And the reason why is because, we'll put up here on the screen next, you can be a successful, incredibly successful person in this world and yet fail with God. Esau, a successful man that most likely is in hell today because he wasn't successful with God. He wasn't successful in the spiritual arena. So just some things to think about in this chapter, just chocked full of just names we can't pronounce, but still some important lessons for us to consider as we look at his life, his descendants' lives versus Jacob's. Let's pray. Father, I never know where we're going to go when we hit a chapter like this. But I believe there are some real important lessons for us to learn as we think about Jacob and Esau, as we think about the worldly success of Esau, and everyone would have been clamoring after what a family he has and clamoring after being in that family and having that kind of fame and power and influence and wealth. And yet we wonder what Esau thinks today. Father, help us to be people that pursue spiritual wealth with you. Through our daily choices and priorities and values, help us to be people who work long and hard for spiritual prosperity in our lives, not the way the health, wealth, and prosperity people are talking about it, but true spiritual prosperity with you and a life with you. Guard us, guard our young people or young adults who are entering the business world and looking for all these great jobs. Lord, just guard them from getting absorbed into that and allowing spiritual prosperity with you to be a second place in their lives. Help us as parents to teach our children, our grandchildren, how to succeed with the Lord more than we teach them how to succeed in this culture. And Lord, as we think about a cemetery outside our windows here, as we drive past, maybe walk through cemeteries, I pray we would be confronted with the question of, what am I really living for? Am I really living for what truly counts? So Lord, make the corrections that need to be made in our lives. Reinforce the decisions we've made. Help us to see the value of laying up treasures in heaven in contrast to this culture that puts so much stock in stuff and fame and making money. For I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.